Well, this is our fifth talk on Heracles. It'll be tonight and two more probably. And most tonight is just going to be telling the stories, and some of them are extremely brief, so we won't go into them. And not too much commentary or too many things to say. We're going to try and cover five labors, beginning with the fourth. And the fourth labor was the capture of the Erymanthian boar, which is another one of those capture alive things, having to do with things that are not to be killed. The Erymanthian boar was found on Mount Lemuria, or Mount Lemuria, or something like that in Arcadia. And Arcadia always has a place in history. If you go back into further into the Mideast, in the area of Persia, you have the Arcadians. We have the Arcadians in Newfoundland, and we have the Cajuns in Louisiana, and going way into Asia. There was a place called Arcadia, but it was more mythical, and it was something like a Shangri-La. It was a place where people were supposed to live immortally, and they were people that were supposed to have great wisdom. In fact, a lot of the Western schools of occult thought have Arcadia as part of their mythos. It undoubtedly has something to do with the fact that it has to do with Arcos, which is another name for the pole star around which everything spins. And Arcadia would then be the land of the North Pole or beyond. And we've been talking a little bit about that in the earlier Heracles talks. But if it is true that this is where the Christ spirit enters and leaves the earth, it's sort of like the Golgotha of the earth, the point in the skull of the earth is at the North Pole. And if the North Pole is very, very highly charged with etheric energy, it probably has something to do with that kind of outlook. I don't know specifically how it works. They always talk about the Temple of Arcadia. You can look at lots of different paintings throughout history, both Steiner's Gertenium and the Healing Temple at Mount Ecclesia in California of the Rosicrucian Fellowship look like paintings that were made by French painters a couple hundred years ago and have to do with the Arcadian ideal. But I don't know how that's all tied in here. In fact, that's not really even too much in the notes. The Erymanthian boar has its source in another myth, that is in the myth of Aphrodite and Adonis, or Venus and Adonis. Venus fell in love with this very, very pretty young man. I believe he was Cyprian, and maybe he was Acadian, and Cyrenian, maybe. And she left heaven and wore rugged clothes, probably very stylish rugged clothes, and she had her trysts with him. And one day, some chap came across her and saw her nude. And she was so outraged by that that she turned him into this huge boar. This is not the Caledonian boar. This is the Erymanthian boar. There was another quest in ancient Greek mythology that had to do with the Caledonian boar, which a lot of heroes participated in. And he was transformed into this huge, huge boar that was doing in a lot of people and wrecking crops and doing things like that. Those bad boars. But at any rate, one of the gods or goddesses was the patron of the young man that was turned into the boar, and the boar got revenge on Venus by goring Adonis to death. All kinds of things there. And this is the task that was set by Eurystheus before Heracles, that he should go and capture this boar and bring it to him alive. He keeps thinking that one of these times Heracles is going to fail and he's going to end up dead and he's going to have the inheritance of the whole kingdom and such like that. That's how weaklings always think. That's the way of the lower nature. But on the way, Heracles just can't stay out of doing good works, and he does in a cruel bandit along the way, and he passes through the area where the centaurs live. And he stays in a mountain cave with Pholus, who is one of the centaurs who entertains him. And they have, you know, like cave people can't have fires too much in the cave, or it gets to be an awfully smoky place. And so they usually have their fires out in front. And Pholus cooks meat for Heracles, but he eats his own raw. I think something like that has to do with the bestial desires, because a lot of the desire meat is desire material is not driven out of the flesh by the cooking process. You know, the cooking process transforms it both chemically and drives out the etheric stuff and the desire material that goes with it. This is not to say that animals are bad, but the life and occupation of the animals is almost completely survival. And so their desire bodies are filled with desires for food or desires for prey, or desires for procreation, things like that. And one of the reasons why eating flesh food is not a very pleasant notion, because you're taking that stuff into you. And the notion of the centaur being half horse and half human in a transitional state from bestiality to human would eat raw flesh. But at any rate, there are in his cave, there are these jars of wine, and he refuses to open them. And then Heracles comes on with this line. He said, well, four generations ago, Dionysus, when he was on his journeys around the world trying to convert people to the wine cult, put these jars of wine here for this very occasion. He recalls that to him, because Heracles knows the mythical stories himself. It brings out a really interesting notion, and that is the notion of prophecy. You find that notion of prophecy much more in the Judaic tradition of religion and mythology. And in fact, their mythology is more historical. And they had this notion of prophecy, you know, all the prophecies that point to the life of Jesus as evidence that Jesus was the one to be the Christos are prophetic. Now, this brings out another side. The Greeks aren't too much into that. I think it was because of the disposition of the Hebrews that this was their way of doing things, because they were so scientific and so historical that they would record their understandings of the cosmos in a historical fashion, which makes them very literally believable. You know, they seem very evidential and less like storytelling, but it almost has the undesired effect of making people think that they're verbatim truth. The notion is, at any rate, of prophecy. I think the reason prophecy works, because not only are the myths, as we see them from the mysteries, the stories connect together all of the principles that are in the spiritual worlds, but in the spiritual worlds is the cosmos itself. And the cosmos itself is made up of these very stories. The primordial atom, which is design of God's plan, the whole evolutionary structure, the way that the creation is worked out, is also itself told in stories. So it's not surprising then that if one looks at the history of the cosmos, that it would be a story. And our bodies are built out of the stories of the gods. Our bodies themselves are, you know, all of them, the way our different vehicles came into being, are part of a storytelling. Things were spoken into us as words. So it's not surprising then that Heracles, who represents the initiate, starts remembering these stories and starts remembering the significance of them and understands that they are totally part of us. We hear those ancient stories and we begin to discover things about ourselves. They don't have to be the very kinds of things that we're talking about in this class. If we just get the principle that in these stories is something that is in us, and that in the telling of these stories we find them in us, and that when we live out these myths in our own experience, we have a fulfilling of what we really are. But at any rate, Heracles recalls this to Pholus, and when you do that to your host is then obliged to serve you. So he starts cracking open these old, old wine jugs, which must be at least 80 years old. And when he does, it lets off a vapor, because that's the way alcohol works. Supposedly that wonder boy, what was his name? That one that was supposedly the one who was supposed to unite Europe before the common market. Caspar Hauser, who was supposed to be a spiritual initiate, that he belonged to the part of humanity that had never fallen and they had never had an incarnation before. And they figured that would be the innocent that could be born into Europe, and nobody would have hocks on him because they would have no vengeance against him from any past lives. But it had the opposite effect, and everybody was against them, because people who are born under the myth of the innocent, which is like Jesus was born under, was born as a complete innocent, everybody is against him. Caspar Hauser was supposedly one of the last of the Napoleonic line, and they took him as an infant and they locked him in a cellar, and he didn't come out until he was 15 years old. He had eyes that were so sensitive he could see stars in the daytime, and he had a phenomenal memory. He had a memory like people had back in Lemuria before the fall, you know, that they could remember whole dictionaries of words and things like that. Didn't have many ratiocinative powers, and especially as related to the senses. None of this is in the notes again, but I'm in that kind of a mood tonight. But he was so sensitive that if somebody had one glass of wine in the room, it affected his consciousness. And he couldn't stand it. He couldn't understand why anybody would want to do that to their consciousness, like drink wine. But at any rate, that's what happened to the centaurs, and they got enraged. And they come and they're going to get the wine for themselves, and they're bringing stones and butcher's knives and fir trees, and they start attacking the cave. They bring all of the instruments. Fir trees are Saturnian, and rocks are Saturnian, and butcher knives are Mars. That lower desire nature out of which the bestiality comes is all Mars and Saturn. They have all those kinds of devices. And Heracles has to defend himself and his host. So he starts taking logs out of the fire and shooting them with his bow and arrow. He always leads with the arrows. And he does a few of them in. And then one of the, I don't remember the full story of the centaurs. I'll have to study up on it, because they're going to come up again in the Heracles myth. But the demigod or the nymph or whoever it is that is their mother protects them by causing it to rain, and that puts out the campfire. And so Heracles has to go into hand-to-hand combat with them, or hand-to-hoof combat or something like that. And he does a few of them in, and then they all start to leave. And as they start to leave, Heracles shoots arrows at them, and he does a few more of them in, but his last arrow pierces the knee of the only one that is really great of the centaurs, who is Chiron, who was the teacher of all of the initiates. And a funny thing happens, because Chiron is immortal. Chiron is different from all of the other centaurs in that he is immortal. And he has this wound now, if you remember, and it's got the poison from the Lernaean Hydra. And it can't kill him, but he has enormous, enormous pain. And so he puts together, being a master of all of the herbs, he puts together a vulnerary poultice, and he tries to heal his wounds, only he can't heal them. And he's in enormous, enormous pain, which bothers Heracles, because Heracles was his friend. I think this has something to do that, you know, that the spirit is invested in matter. That the creative act of spirit, the spirit projects itself into matter. It projects itself into the unknown. And in fact, I think it actually congeals matter out of the unknown or out of ignorance. It congeals it as sort of a reflective image of what spirit is. Even though it doesn't know what is in matter, and there is always something new, new wisdom, new potential that is in matter, and when it invests itself in matter, then within matter, that part of spirit that is within it is sort of like an instinctual wisdom. And that commingles with the unknown, and the wisdom that is becoming, or the knowledge that is becoming out of the unknown in matter, is sort of then assisted by this instinctual knowledge, and it becomes a wisdom of nature. And so the whole myth of Chiron, which I don't think we're going to get a chance to go into in itself, the whole myth then of Chiron is a myth of the coming out of the bestial nature into humankind and into actually aspirational humankind aspiring to spirituality. It's not surprising then that nature lore and the understanding of that wisdom becoming in nature should be the property of the of Chiron. But at any rate, he goes off on his own, and he has enormous, enormous suffering, and he eventually gives up his immortality. Not so much because of the wound, he could live with the suffering, but just because he became world-weary, and he eventually, Chiron confers his immortality on Prometheus, who the gods tried to do in the first place. Okay, at any rate, when the battle is over, Pholus, we haven't even gotten to the boar yet. when Pholus is looking over after the battle, he sees that some of his fellow centaurs had only very superficial wounds, and they died, and he marvels at this, and he picks up one of the arrows, and he's looking at it, and he fumbles, and he drops it, and it pokes him in the foot, and he dies. And then Heracles had to bury him, and after this is all taken care of, he finally sets out into the mountains to get the boar. He finds the boar where boars like to hide, which is in a thicket. Even in the desert, they like to hide. You know, there are boars in the desert. They're very funny kinds of boars. They're javelinas. They're very vicious. Most of the time, they're frightened. But if you get them cornered, like in a little arroyo or something like that, they can be very, very vicious. They know how to use their tusks quite well. But at any rate, he finds it in a thicket, and he hoots and hollers, and he drives it out of the thicket and keeps chasing it, and he drives it into the snow. And when he drives it into the snow, he binds it in chains, and he carries it on his shoulders all the way to Mycenae. And because Eurystheus is hiding in his big brass urn underground, when he hears Heracles coming, Heracles just drops it, and he goes off. This is really interesting. The boar itself, I think I've mentioned it at other times, that the boar, more than any other animal, because it has a small tail, represents wisdom. In the animal kingdom, where the animals do not yet have the intelligence centered in the brain because the etheric body is not perfectly concentric with the physical and the spirit is not therefore capable of being indwelling, it can't have a concrete mind being interior. Therefore, the internal energy, the creative energy that is theirs, that would normally go into thought process and that would go into spoken words and other expressions, normally goes out the tail. And this is why animals do a tremendous amount of their expressing with the tail. But an animal that has a small tail has a small outlet for that. And therefore, there is an enormous buildup of energy within, cosmic wisdom or cosmic spiritual energy, that can't be released in the normal way. And pig's tails are spirals also, which would be an indication of some very spiritually wise kind of being. In fact, even their penises are spirals. I don't want to get too carried away, or things can get pretty wild. But at any rate, the energy that would normally be turned into brain power and creative energy or released through the tail, as much of it as possible, goes out in the potency of the manure, and pig manure is tremendously potent. But what is left over goes into building more and more flesh. And that flesh then is truly a manifestation of cosmic wisdom. And this is why in all mythologies, the boar has been the symbol of cosmic wisdom. Like Buddha, for example, who was a vegetarian all of his life and completely harmless. Myth has it, or legend has it, that he died from eating too much pork. And if he didn't eat pork, that's probably an indication that he was consuming wisdom that he could not consume and remain in the human state. And then there is the Norse boar, that the heroes who fought every day were sat down to a table in which they ate boar's flesh, and as they carved the flesh off, there would be more that would be reproduced while they were there. And this was roast boar, meaning that it was conditioned for human consumption. And that's truly the way the spiritual wisdom is. You can't know something, but no sooner do you take a cut of it away, and there's much more of it there. So this is a myth about capturing wisdom, but it also has to do with desire. Because if you look at this, the boar is chased into the snow. And snow is frozen water. And water itself has always been one of the symbols of desire. And this is some kind of process where the cosmic wisdom as manifest in the flesh or in nature. You see, this is the way we're going to see this again several times in the Heracles myths, that the attendant parts of the story have as much to do as the actual action itself. And the attendant part with the struggle with the centaurs having to do with wisdom embedded in nature is the same as the boar itself. And so the freezing of the emotions has something to do with the objectification of desire, so that one can capture the objects, because all of the animals, the world of the animals, like for example is called in Tibetan mythology, that's the name for the desire world, because that's where the animal group spirits are. And they say when you die, first you go to the world of the animals. They have the in the great Bhava chakra, they have the world of the animals, where the, because it's the astral world, it's the desire world, where the animal forces or the astral forces, the stellar forces that are behind the signs of the zodiac, that are behind the kingdoms of animals as associated with the zodiac, that the whole desire world is like that, and the, therefore the animal represents an objectification of a whole mythos of one type of desire. All of the animal kingdoms and species are like that. But the process then of thinking is one way of objectifying desire. The cold, crystallizing power of thought takes the water and solidifies it. Or also, the people who are very thoughtful like that are sometimes unfeelingful. And being unfeelingful, they manifest the cold force in the desire world, which is indifferent. What do we say about a person? We say that a person is cold and indifferent. Those are two adjectives that are put together all the time. And so the ability then to track and this most this huge beast, which is an objectification of desire or wisdom in desire, is brought about by the crystallizing power of thought and or the power of indifference. And when he catches it, he binds it in chains, saying the desire always leads to action, and that's the connection again of chains. So that's pretty much the notion of it, and it is interesting because if you look in Greece, that means this had to have been a winter myth, because that's the only time that it snows in Greece. And if it's a winter myth, that means that this is indeed the Yule boar, again, which is the same boar of wisdom that they, it's all tied together, and you have those kinds of things happening. It's not, nobody knows exactly what the fate of the boar is. It's not in any of the renditions that have come down to us from Greek times. None of the renditions tell what actually happened to the boar afterwards. Maybe it became part of a Yule feast, I don't know. But at any rate, when this labor is accomplished, Heracles just drops it on the ground and leaves, because on the way he has heard that there is a gathering of heroes to participate in the quest. I was almost tempted to do a spin-off into another whole series of myths, and this was the quest of the Golden Fleece, which has to do with the equinox, the procession of the equinox going from Taurus to into Aries, that no longer are they questing after the bull and fighting the bull of taking the bull by the horns, but it's now the time of the Golden Fleece. And I was going to take that as Jason and the Argonauts, but I decided not to take that as my quest myth because there are several other kinds of myths that we've been neglecting altogether that I want to get to later. All right, so Heracles goes off and has this, got the notes upside down on the way I'm using them tonight. It might just as well be that way. He goes off and participates in the quest. And when he gets back, Eurystheus has another labor for him. It is the fifth labor, and this is the one Eurystheus has been looking for all along. He's sitting down in his brass urn. Yeah, Heracles is being too successful, and even if he's successful in this one, Eurystheus will have the last laugh on him, and so will Hera, though she's beginning to become edgy right now. And it is the cleaning of the Augean stables, or the Augeas' stables. Augeas was the son of the Titan Helios, who was the charioteer of the sun. And so this gives us, again, an orientation that the whole myth is solar in nature. And because the sun at that time was associated with Taurus, the equinox was still associated with Taurus, being the son of the sun, he is given a blessing in animals, most especially cattle. But he has sheepfolds and everything. And he has at least 300 special black and white bulls. And he has 200 red bulls. And he has 12 very special silver white bulls that were sacred to Poseidon, who also blessed him. But these were the core. He had a situation that the gods blessed him, that all of his unions between cattle were fertile. And he had also another situation that his cows were immune to illness, or all of his animals were immune to illness. And even though they don't multiply as fast as rabbits, you can see that soon he had enormous, enormous amounts of animals. And he was not a good farmer in that he didn't take care of the manure. And so he had, even with these outdoor pens, almost his entire kingdom was covered with manure. And they were gated in with stones, and it got to be somewhat self-destructive because there was so much manure that it was burning out the soil. And nothing would grow on the soil anymore because it was just too much nitrogen burnout. And, but at any rate, they hadn't been cleaned for at least 60 years. And so it has something to do with for three generations. And it was going into the fourth generation, which is where we are. We're in the fourth period of evolution. It has something to do with things that have been building up in us. To some extent, we are deposits of the gods. We are, in some ways, the gods' shit, because marriage and creation are tied together. But normally, you know, the creative force normally goes into the brain, but there's so much of it that it goes out through the duff. We'll come back to that in a little bit. But we've been receivers and receivers and receivers. And we've been accumulating all of these blessings from the gods, and we need a good cleaning out. You know, we become more and more material, and since the fall, we've lost our creative power. And so here we are in the fourth period, the fourth generation of the cosmos, because it's gone to sleep after the first three nights. And so in the fourth generation, we're pretty well clogged up. But at any rate, Eurystheus had this vision of Heracles having to take big, you know, bushel baskets of manure and pack them full and then put them on his shoulder and haul them away. And Heracles comes and looks over the situation and has this meeting with Augeas. And at this point, he's getting a little cocky. And he looks it all over, and Augeas thinks he's drunk. And he does something that he does only one time in his life. Once and only, he says, "For a small tithe of your cattle, I will clean your stables in one day." One day. And Augeas figures he's got a sucker here. And he brings his son Phyleus to be witness to this. And Heracles swears by his father's name. Now, spiritual students almost never, never take oaths. You know, let your yeas be yeas and let your nays be nays, because there's something about the taking of oaths that is basically weakening. Because if you do that, you crystallize for yourself one and only one path, the path that you have sworn an oath to. And about the future, we must certainly remain free and open. And that the whole notion, especially on your father's name, to swear an oath is quite a strong statement. If you're doing that, you have locked yourself in into one course of action, and it sort of weakens you because you have a brittle kind of destiny, and you have a brittle consciousness if you swear oaths. You look at the people that are most adamant about oath swearing or non-oath swearing, and the negative comes in there too, are people that are very brittle personalities. But at any rate, he swears an oath about another thing that is also loathsome to me as a mystery student, and that's the notion of tithes, like a percentage that he's he demands a tithe for a portion of for his work. Now, truly, if he is a son of Zeus and doing this to the glory of Zeus and Hera, his whole life should be for the divine, and he shouldn't have to ask for a tithe for anything. You see what I mean? He gets himself into trouble. I can become very, this whole notion of it takes away it. I understand that for some people, quotas to keep them in line or quotas to get them to aspire to something, to use a practice like that to set a timetable or have a quota is sometimes a wise practice if you can keep constantly in mind that this is only a quota, or it's only a tithe. That can be, that can be an all right thing, but to make it as your whole way of life is an error. It precludes using good judgment, because there are times when it is better judgment. It makes good sense, both in terms of your obligations to the world, to spend more on paying your bills and on less on giving to the church. Whereas other times, there are times when any kind of charity, a church or other, needs some special behest, and you go overboard. You make a special case for that. And I think that the whole notion of tithing by a percentage is a stupid thing. But at least that's what Heracles did. He cuts this deal, and he should have known right away. Because the first thing that happens after he cuts the deal is one of the 12 guard bulls, Poseidon's guard bulls, sees the lion's pelt he's wearing and confuses it for a lion and comes and attacks. And Heracles grabs it by one horn and he bulldozes it and sticks it into the ground with its one horn. He pins it down. And I think this has something to say about the fact that we're going to see that coming out a little more, that this labor happened after the Golden Fleece, the quest of the Golden Fleece, and that means the pinning of the animal to the ground is showing that the way of the bull is past, and it's now the time of the Golden Fleece. This is sort of like the retrogression that took place after the escape from Egypt of the Hebrews. You know, Moses went to get the new dispensation, which was the law, which is opposite Aries, And while he was gone, the people reverted back to the golden calf. They made the image of the golden calf, and they reverted back to the old ways. And Moses came back and really read them the law at that point. So this is, you know, it's sort of hinting at that. So what he does is, after he's cut the deal and he's pinned the bull, what he does is he goes and looks. He's already cased the situation before he made his braggadocious statement or his vow, and he goes and he opens up the stone walls at one end of the pens, and then he opens up the stone walls at the other end of the pens, and then he redirects two rivers, the rivers Alpheus and Pentheus, and he directs all of their water into the pens, and they flow through, and they take all of the merit, and they wash it down to the sea, and the pens are cleansed in one day. Pretty good deed. But then he comes, and Augeas doesn't want to pay him. And we'll come to that in just a little bit. Clearly, this, if our ability to think depends upon the shit that's in our brains, meaning to say the amount of nitrogen that is deposited in our brains has to do with our astuteness of thinking in the physical world. But if we get too physical, too much thinking in a worldly cunning, and we get very materialistic, then we deposit too much uric acid, not only in our brains, but in our entire bodies, and we become phlegmatic and gouty. You know what I'm trying to say? These people that are very contented about the physical world and have all of their values about material things have that as their big problem. But at any rate, the accumulation of merit in the brain, or the accumulation of merit, you might say, in all of our bodies, is what this is all about. Now again, this is, if we look at this, this is the same thing as we saw last week when he went into the two-mouthed cave and fought the lion. In that case, he blocked off, early in the stages to isolate, he blocked off one of the passages of the cave. In this case, he opens two passages and causes a flow to come through. This is a principle that works on many levels. That healing, if we have a flow, a continuous flow coming from the divine worlds through our soul, from the mind, through our desires, through our actions, and finally manifest in the physical body, this is very cleansing and very healing. This is a good mystical experience. A direct flow of the divine into our character cleans out an awful lot of merit, so that you can change overnight a lot of your character. And so that even just thinking on lofty things and bringing to become manifest, even as little essays or little paintings or something like that, or make up your own stories, it has that very same effect. The same could be true of saying, if we don't use our senses enough, we can actually have the stream go the other direction. We can have it go from the world of the senses back into the realm of the gods, and it also has the cleansing effect and the sharpening effect on our senses. But I want to look at it more physiologically than that. The stable of Augeas could be seen as the head, because that's where most of the uric acid is found, and that's what is associated with our extremely materialistic thought and consciousness. And the two rivers probably are the two flows of the spinal energy that rises from the generative organs up into the spine. And so when we produce our own Golgotha, and have that thing where we have a flow where the creative energy flows through the brain and out, that you know, then we have redirected those energies rather than from them being downward into bestial kinds of thinking. When we direct those energies through the two paths, first one, the mystical path, where it goes through the heart first, and then into the head, and the other where it goes straight up the spine and into the head and back by the route of the heart, that when both streams are poured into the head, there is this tremendous cleansing change of consciousness, and such an balanced individual is one that has the clear, open consciousness of the initiate. And I think something like that is what's involved in this labor. I can't say that we can take all the labor sequentially. What we're looking at tonight, rather than the last time we looked at them in terms of vehicles. We had a vehicular outlook about the labors of Heracles. Tonight we're just looking at techniques. And we're in this case we're talking about the redirection of spiritual spinal fire, or the redirection of the consciousness that is extroverted and introverted through the total constitution of our being. But at any rate, Augeas won't pay, and so what always happens is when you once start taking vows and swear by something, then you've made it legal, and then you're brittle, so Heracles then has to demand an arbitration. You know, you're stuck in the law courts. Once you get away from the spontaneous spiritual life, that's it. But at any rate, he seeks an arbitration, and the first thing he does is he calls Phileus as his witness. And I guess heredity in blood is stronger than law, so instead of saying, "I object," what Augeas does is he banishes his own son from his kingdom for life, so he can't testify. So Heracles testifies in his own behalf that he had this deal with... And therefore, it should be honored that this is the deal that we cut. However, Augeas, being a man of the world, he was much more clever than that. He said, "Heracles didn't do the job. The river spirits did the job, and therefore I don't have to pay him." And in the arbitration, Heracles lost. In fact, he lost doubly. This always happens when you once, if you're leading the spiritual life, you live by the laws, you're a good citizen, but you live in accordance with the law, but you don't live by the law. You don't define yourself, because if you're living the spiritual life, you have to get beyond the law. You have to transcend to the creative source that is behind all of the law. And so he loses doubly, because... Eurystheus, when he gets wind of this, says this doesn't count as one of the labors. And the reason it doesn't count as one of the labors is because you were under somebody else's hire. You cut this deal, and that means that invalidates this. And this is the second time now that this has happened to him. It's happened once before. Killing of the Lernaean Hydra was discounted because he had help from his shield bearer, from his porter and charioteer. And Eurystheus said, "You got to do these alone." And so this one didn't count. And this has something to do, it's a very, very deep topic. I don't understand all of it. I could tell you the old story of how there used to be 10 signs to the zodiac. And at one time, that what is now Virgo and Libra and Scorpio all used to be one area. It was Caduceus of Mercury. It covered that whole area. The eagle was at the top of the Caduceus of the Mercury with the wings, and the snakes and the staff were in the Virgo part. And it was all one sign, and that somewhere the zodiac had to be divided differently. the Ten Commandments were the old ways, and they were associated with the first 10 signs of the zodiac. But after that got, after we got beyond that, then the law was instituted because we fell. But once the law was there, we could then rise above the law. And the two commandments that were given by Christ that went beyond the Ten Commandments of the zodiac, that associated with the signs of the zodiac, which were mostly prohibitive commandments, the commandments of Christ were positive commandments. They become then associated with the last two signs of the zodiac that have to do with Aquarius, love thy neighbor as thyself, which is not the golden rule. It's much stronger than the golden rule. Because if you love your neighbor as yourself, then that love is transcendent to self. The golden rule is more like living in, playing karma. I'll do this unto my neighbor because I'd like to have them do it unto me. But if you love your neighbor as yourself, you're loving them in the way that God loves, which is, with the altruistic love of Aquarius. Whereas the second commandment of Christ, to love thy God with all thy heart and all thy mind and all thy soul, which is the character of Pisces, which is of that very devout nature. Okay, we could talk about that as the two of the labors were discounted, and that this is the difference between the ancient 10 sign zodiac and the modern 12 sign zodiac. But I think there's something more to it than that. But I don't understand it yet. I'll throw it out, and as you come to understand, you can help me with it. I think it has something to do with the actual structure of the ancient zodiac, because the Chinese had the 10 branches and the 12 stems, and they have their five-element system, as well as taking into account our four-element system. And the five elements in positive and negative were associated with the 10 branches. And what I'm talking about is this. There is a union between numerology and geometry. That with the 10 branches, it talks about the decad. The number 9, as we talked about last time when we talked about Heracles having one of his fingers cut off, chewed off by the lion, and he had 9 fingers, which represented him as the true human, because 9 is the number of humanity. The apotheosized human is associated with the number 10. They've gone beyond the human state and they've become divine. This is the number 10 is the number, it's the phi, or it's the, sigma, and in both cases it is the io. Remember the everything that came into existence from the union of Zeus and Io, when she took the form of a cow. This has nothing to do with the procession of the equinox. It has much more to do with the divine cow of creation, as it was in the Greek mythology. The number 10 is numerologically, as far as human intelligence is concerned, a threefold body, a threefold soul, and a threefold spirit is a total human. But when they all get united through the length, through the link of mind, and we become divine beings, we then become a 10-part person, and we are then divine. And so in divinity, or the octave of humanity, is associated with the number 10 arithmetically. But if we have the, if we take the points in space and wrap them around each other in three-dimensional consciousness, in the three-dimensional world, the most you can get are 12 points around the 13th. And so that 1 is always surrounded by 12 in the contiguous points of space of cosmic root substance. So that what we have is that 12 represents the octave number for the cosmos. And somehow the nature, the relationship of 10 and 12 has something to do with the union of frequency in arithmetic, in counting from 1 to 10, which is what the Pythagoreans did all the time. And I find myself, when I'm trying to keep myself, my consciousness busy, or when I am in neurotic behavior, I find myself doing Pythagorean dot triangles, counting to 10, because I'm pretty certain that I was associated with Pythagoreanism several lives ago. But this has to do with uniting in our consciousness arithmetic, which has to do with the spinner, which is the Holy Spirit, and geometry, which is the divine spirit. And the 10 and the 12 has something to do with the union in our consciousness of activation on different levels. So I think that's what's involved with the discounting of two of the labors, and which is a deductive way of saying things. If you discount two of the labors, that's like saying 10 is a deduction from 12. Yeah, or that there was an entity that was 10 within 12, and by the deduction from it, you come to the unity that is 10. But that's, spiritual thinking thinks deductively, because you work from the universal to the particular. You work from the one that is God to all of the things that are possible within God. And that's the IO has to do with the one and the zero within God. But I don't want to get too far aside on all of this. But at any rate, he has done this labor, and it is discounted. And we have finished five of the labors of Heracles. Unfortunately, we have almost nothing to say about the next three labors, because the next three labors have so little said about them. The stories are not very ramified, and so there's nothing to do but a lot of wild speculation, which I love to do, and especially what I say about the Stymphalian birds, which is the next labor. He was to drive all of the Stymphalian birds out of the swamp at Stymphalos. Now, these birds were found the world over, but for some reason they were bothered. They were frightened mostly by wolves, and wolves are lower desires usually. They're the dog, the god spelled backwards, you might say. The wolves are ravenous in that way. But they were brazen-beaked, brazen-clawed, and they were winged with brazen wings. And they were sort of, they seemed to merge mythologically with the birds that were called the harpies. They had supposedly bodies that were about the size of cranes, and there are various notions about where they came from, but nobody really seems to know. Some people claim that they were metamorphized women. For having done some kind of wrong, they were turned into brazen birds, and we know that bronze again is associated with sin. But at any rate, they collect in this swamp or in this quagmire, zodiacally, or in the, not even zodiacally, in the constellations of the heavens. The Stymphalian birds are all found in the sector of Scorpio, but to the north. Scorpio itself, as a constellation, is one of the Stymphalian birds. It was pictured as a diving eagle, and that what we now see as the tail of the eagle was a serpent that was in its mouth. And the eye of the eagle is Antares. So that bright red star with the little green one inside of it, that describes Scorpio pretty well. Vicious and violent, the red eye, and it's got a little gleam of green jealousy inside of it. But as you go north, you have the constellation of Lyra, which was a harp that was made in the form of an eagle, and it is another diving eagle. And then across the Milky Way from it, you have another eagle, Aquila, is there, and that was one of these Stymphalian birds. And flying right down the Milky Way is Cygnus, the better part of the body of which forms the Northern Cross. And Heracles is located right around there. Between the Stymphalian birds and Scorpio, Heracles is located with his club. And one of the arrows that he shot at the Stymphalian birds is located just south of the head of, just a little bit south of Fox and Goose, which is south of the head of the Cygnus the Swan, where again, where we should be outside looking at this in the stars on a dark night. And one of the arrows is there, Sagitta, and that's when I was first began studying star lore and looking at the constellations and gazing. One of the first times I got out in the country where my parents were living, and I looked out there and I looked up in the sky and I saw the arrow. And I had never read a book about it or anything like that. And I said, I know there is a constellation called Sagitta, and that must be it. And I looked, and I got home, and I ran for astronomy books, and there it was. But at any rate, this is a, they're supposedly associated with Scorpio. And Scorpio is sort of the stagnant water swamps of the zodiac. In some regard, you could say again that the swamps represent the stagnant area of the sexual organs, or again, they represent the brain where the scorpionic nitrogenous manure is found at the other end. But at any rate, they gathered around the quagmire, and it was another one of those quagmires that you couldn't walk on, and you couldn't, it was too thin to walk on and too thick to ride a boat through. It seems like a lot of marshes or quagmires are like that. And so what he had to do, Athena, if I'm not mistaken, Athena was in the story of the Stymphalian birds, that Athena was the one that pronounced the curse that changed the women into harpies, the bronze birds. They had terrible habits about them. They bothered the Argonauts so much so that every time that they put out food to eat, the harpies would come down and eat the food, and it'd make a really terrible raucous noise, and their excrement was poisonous. This is a night for poisonous excrement, I don't know why. And clearly what these represent are bad thoughts. Nobody knows where bad thoughts come from, but they prey on you and they seem to coalesce together. And when they coalesce together, they produce entities, whether you want to call them constellations, as Jung did, or whether you want to call them complexes, as Freud did, that they produce very nasty little knots of thinking that any time that you get anywhere near to thinking that way, you're carried away in a storm of bad thoughts that you can't do anything about. Now, Athena is helpful to Heracles in this case in that she gives him brazen castanets. They're bronze too. And so what he does is he goes with the castanets and he gets to the swamp and he shakes them so loudly that they're terrified, and they go off in all directions. And when they're once separated, he can deal with them. And he then downs quite a few of them with his arrows. A number of them get away. One never catches all of one's thoughts unless you can be completely transcendent about it. And many of them fly away to the Isle of Ares, because Ares, A-R-E-S, who is the Grecian Mars, he was their patron, and they fly away there where they have protection. Now, this is a really interesting concept. Most of what I have to say is speculative because I don't have an answer to this. But loud sound. Sound is a most peculiar entity. loud sounds break neurotic patterns. For example, there are children that are so carried away in the storm of nervous pseudo-thought that they can't concentrate. They can't concentrate and read. And do you know that teachers who shout at those children as loud as they can, they say, "I love you, but I'm shouting at you to help you to break this buzz that's in you," that when they shout at the children, that those children learn to read much better, much faster. They make progress in weeks' time that it took months, many months' time previously to learn. So there's something about sound power that both forms and breaks habits. Now, it's most interesting that sound, when it is diffused, is the most peaceful sort of thing. The reason why a forest is peaceful is because most of the sound is diffused and absorbed. It's broken into frequencies, or it's scattered so that you don't hear it, which is much different than being on a desert. Being on a desert or being on a mountaintop when you're beyond the tree line is like a deep state of concentration or a deep state of meditation. The desert or the mountaintop is quiet because it's quiet, because nothing's happening. It's not because the sound is being diffused. But the diffused sound, you might say that all of the words of the gods, when they break up, become like white noise. And white noise is very, very peaceful. You know, it's something that puts you in a state where you can't, it's hard to be nervous listening to white noise. If you ever sit down and try to do deep thinking next to, especially a waterfall, I find that there is something in our consciousness that doesn't listen to the sound, or when the sound gets into broken patterns, it listens in the pockets in the sound. It listens in the intervals. And when you start finding the intervals in the noise, you open yourself up to a kind of consciousness that is very intuitive. So white noise is both very soothing because it provides a constant background, and a constant background that is not repetitive, but it's a constancy. But at the other extreme, we have what Heracles is talking about, or what Heracles does, and that is bringing in sharp new sounds. Now, different people have different notions about what the creative word is that has brought the entire cosmos into existence. Some people think it is a nervous laugh, or some people feel it's a laugh that is a joy of relief. And then one of the other schools of thought is that it is a command, a shout. And what this seems to be implying is that we're looking at these as the hero, as the initiate, and we're looking at, or the aspirant to initiation, we're looking at ourselves as being that, and we're trying to find technique tonight. And the technique that we're looking at is for breaking up patterns of bad thoughts, negative thoughts. And this says that the shocking quality of new sound coming in raw and pure from chaos has the ability to break up all of our old patterns. Therefore, if we want to change our thinking patterns, if we can put ourselves in such a place where we take in things that are totally new, totally unheard of by ourselves, that in doing that we break up our old patterns, especially our old negative patterns, because otherwise you're going to become too dependent on them. we become, to, you know, you get to thinking a certain way so long and you feel at home with it and you feel secure when you're in that way of thinking. And I think this is all speculative, but I'm trying to understand it as, you know, like the first time a person has vision or the perception of the world of thought itself. At first it seems silent, and then the music of the spheres comes booming in. And I think that when we understand the objective realities, which are the creative archetypes in the world of thought, that they are truly booming, as subtle as they may be, they're booming, and our little nests of harpies or of Stymphalian types of destructive thoughts, they just can't hold together doing that. But at any rate, that's what he does. He kills some and he drives the rest of them away. I assume they'll have to be dealt with at some time or another. And this is a really prevalent myth. Different people have different ways of dealing with them. For example, in the Arabian Nights, the Arabian Nights used to wear chainmail to defend themselves against the harpies, not because they thought they were going to be attacked by them, but when the harpies did come around and get at them, they would get their talons hooked in the chainmail and they could break their necks. That's the way they dealt with them. I sort of like Heracles way better because I think it has something cosmic. If you happen to have meditations on this, or if you happen to study something somewhere that gives this idea about sound power, I would be very interested in what you have to say about it. Years ago, I used to be interested in idophones. And, you know, there are people that have at different times made devices that you can impart sound onto oil colors floating on water. And do you know that if you say the Om in an idophone, that what you produce is the symbol of the sun? There's a little ball in the center and a perfect circle. And there, at another time, in the old days, the old camera club in New York City, they had footage of a woman who could impart to oil colors floating on water. She had made a device where she could make polar coordinate figures, like she could make four-leaf clovers and things like that, just with the power of the voice. But that's all neither here nor there. We better get on with this, otherwise we're going to be a little bit longer than an hour, I guess. The seventh labor is the labor of the Cretan bull. This is the shortest of all the labors, and almost nothing is said about it. It's the Cretan bull was the property of King Minos, even though it wasn't supposed to be. King Minos was a subject of Poseidon, Neptune, and he was supposed to sacrifice all of his animals to Poseidon, but he held one back, and this was the one he held back, and he got himself into all kinds of trouble for it. In the first place, his wife slept with the bull. She was sort of like Catherine the Great. she had a thing for bulls. And wife was, again, a daughter of Helios. This time we have a daughter of Helios, which again ties us all into the procession of the equinox. His wife's name was Pasiphae, and I think that's how it's pronounced, I'm not sure. P-A-S-I-P-H-A-E, Pasiphae. And as a result of this union between the bull and his wife was produced the monstrosity that was the Minotaur. And then he had this monstrosity that had a horrible appetite for eating humans. And he, in order to not knowing what to deal with, how to deal with it, because he really couldn't deal with it because it was a representation of his own sin, you know, because he hadn't sacrificed all to God, And because there was a bestiality involved, this living creature that had these horrendous habits, so what he did is he hired Daedalus. Remember the clever builder Daedalus? And Daedalus built the maze around it, and it was kept in the maze, but he still had to keep feeding it youths. And that's eventually Theseus was the one that contemporary hero of Heracles. Theseus actually went in and eventually killed the Minotaur. But Heracles' duty was to get rid of it. It was typical of all bulls, especially all bulls that represented the processional bull Taurus at this time in history. When the sun was rising in that constellation of Taurus, and when it rose in the morning, the first rays of dawn came out, and they were seen poetically by the ancients as the bull was belching or breathing fire. So you find there are quite a few myths from this period in history that you have fire-breathing bulls. I don't think you'll find that in any books, but that's all right. When you work with star lore, you're looking at physical objects. And when you look at physical objects and you try to, you're using an imagination that is related to something spiritual, but you have to use your imagination and see how the spiritual things can be seen in physical stuff. And it's great fun. At any rate, the bull was causing all kinds of trouble. It was doing the normal things. It was knocking down the orchard walls and eating up all the fruit and destroying all the good crops and things like that. And nobody could get around it without being gored. And having learned his lesson after the experience with the Augean stables, Heracles refuses all help, though plenty is offered by people. And he's at the point now when there are camp followers and everybody wants, you know, they're starting to get on the bandwagon. And he just goes and single-handedly wrestles with it and more or less tames it. And puts it on a boat and takes it back to Greece, and he gives it to Eurystheus, who doesn't know what to do with it, so he just lets it loose. And when it's let loose, it goes from city to city in Greece, and it causes all kinds of trouble. This is another instance, again, that this is after the quest of the Golden Fleece, and to have anything to do with the sacred bull is going to cause you all kinds of trouble. You're practicing an ancient religion, false doctrine, as Linus said when he, remember, you know, Linus and Charlie Brown, he goes out looking for the great pumpkin every year, and he's going to rise out of the most sincere pumpkin patch, and he's going to bring goodies to all the kids, and Charlie Brown tells him, no, that's Christmas, but he gets hooked into going for the great pumpkin anyway. And the great pumpkin doesn't appear, and he talks to Linus about it later, and Linus says, I was the victim of false doctrine. And this is what happens when the equinox precesses from Taurus to Aries. But at any rate, Hera chases it from city to city, and it keeps causing problems until Theseus captures it. He's already captured the Minotaur, and he's back in Athens now. When the bull comes causing trouble at Athens, he captures it and sacrifices to Athena, who has forgiven him all of his things. And that's the end of that story. There's not too much to it. And we have one more very short story about which I don't know anything, so it'll be a lot of speculation. And when I don't know anything, I ask questions, so I'll ask questions of you again. The eighth labor is the mare of Diomedes. And there's often a lot of confusion about Diomedes. This is King Diomedes of Thrace, the city of Briston. He's the king there. This is not Diomedes that fought with Ares in the Trojan War and that was sort of a hero himself and who also had horses, but this is not the same one. A lot of people have been confused about that, including somebody who wrote a book on the 12 labors of Heracles associated with the 12 signs of the zodiac, and as far as I'm concerned, knew nothing about either. But I won't drop any names on that because I don't want to take cheap shots. Well, I'll take semi-cheap shots. In some myths, it's not that they were mares, but that they were stallions, and they're all given different names. One is called Podargus, which means bright feet. One is called Lampon, which means beaming. One is called Xanthus, which means yellow. And one is called Dinus, which means terrible. But these horses had unusual appetites. They liked living on flesh. So we're back again to the centaur theme. Where we began is where we're going to end. And clearly, they had been trained to eat flesh by Diomedes. He thought this was a cute thing, you know. It's something not too far away from having boa constrictors and raising mice and throwing those little creatures in there to be eaten up, and I don't know. That's just something. But at any rate, Heracles does take help. I don't understand this, but he sails, goes across the sea to Thrace, and he takes a whole shipload full of volunteers. Again, there are all kinds of people that are willing to be with him now. And he goes to the stables, he sneaks there, and he overpowers the stable guards, and he just takes the horses right in the rain. And they're unruly, but he takes them, and he pulls them, and he takes them down to the sea. And he leaves them on a grassy knoll by the sea, and about this time the Diomedes has all the Bristones coming after him, and Heracles doesn't know what to do, and they're coming across the lower plain of Bristone, and what Heracles does is quickly digs a trench. Believe it or not, he quickly digs a trench from the sea, and all the sea runs into the lower plain of Bristone and forms a lake. And they can't get to him. And so he goes around the lake and takes his club, his wild olive tree club, which was probably a whole wild olive tree, and he stuns Diomedes over the head, and he takes his body and he drags it all the way around the lake, and he leaves it on the grassy knoll, and Diomedes' horses eat the body of Diomedes. Which is, I think what the myth is trying to talk about is we're talking about the horse having something to do, or the centaur having something to do with the bestial side of the lower nature. And if we develop our desire bodies, and in the lower desire world, that we feed on desires, that we charge them up, you know what I mean? That we revel in them and that we make them, we empower them. That's sort of like what the, when I focus on the myth, that's what comes to me. It's that we feed these ravenous desires and, you know, it's possible in what is called eternal damnation in Christian mysticism, that is when the individuality produces a personality wherein the ego gets so strong that the ego, the lower ego, takes and pulls the vehicles, the mind, the desire nature, the etheric vital body, and the physical. It hardens them so much that it pulls them away from the Spirit, and the Spirit has not the wherewithal to continue on in evolution. And that's creating the whole lower nature as an entity that is the most terrible, bestial entity of all. And the thing of it is that entity appears to be very suave and cultural and very intelligent and very cunning at the same time. I would recommend reading the book A Strange Story by Edward Bulwer Lytton. And in that novel, the description of the eternal damnation when the spirit pulls away from the body and this very intelligent, smooth, sophisticated entity is left behind. That is actually the actual pulling away is described in the course of that novel. It's most astounding that somebody could put something like that into words. But so Bulwer Lytton did write something other than "It was a dark and stormy night." He was actually the person who wrote that. Zanoni is supreme, but A Strange Story has a lot more intellectual, spiritual philosophy about it. But at any rate, if we create something in our desire nature, if we create entities in there, in our desire nature, by feeding them certain kinds of indulgence, where we go into this desire and make it bigger and bigger and bigger, that makes that desire, when it is empowered that much that the spirit can't control it, that is what happens with addictions. And eventually your addictions come and eat everything that's healthy about you. You see what I'm trying to say? And that the mares of Diomede or the stallions of Diomede represents that kind of a state where you have produced something in your bestial consciousness thinking, isn't that cute? Or isn't this a great joy that is going to turn and rend you? But at any rate, once they've eaten his body up, they have to try to digest and assimilate it, and they can't do that, and all of their energy is on the process, and they become very tame and docile. And he loads them onto the ship and takes them back to Greece, where they are let loose on Mount Olympus, again sacred to Hera. Eurystheus lets them loose on Mount Olympus, and they stay there until the wild animals eat them, which is consistent with the thesis that I'm putting forth for interpretation, because the wild animals represent the desire of the macrocosmic manifestations of the macrocosmic desire world. Each animal represents the embodiment of one species of desire, whereas tame animals represent desires that are of human character, because we have tamed them. You know, like in your dreams, if you have wild animals in them, I would say there are four categories of animals that you can have in your dreams that represent different kinds of desires. The desires that are most personalized are not only tamed, but they're pets, they're intimates. They represent desires that are in the highest state of transformation. Whereas domesticated animals represent desires that have been tamed and that are where you're becoming humane or humanized. Then among the wild animals, which represent the bestial desires and things that are associated with the unruly parts of nature, where the unconscious is there, there are two types of wild animals. There are prey and, of course, the most wild of all predators. And this is like saying that the nature takes care of its own. Supposedly that the what happens, this goes back to the tone story again, none of this is in the notes again, this goes back to the tones, that when the spirit is removed from the body because it can no longer control it, the spiritual vehicles are broken up by tone power. And eventually that's the way the lower nature is broken up too, but that can live for tens of thousands of years as a most malignant kind of being. But at any rate, there's another version of this story that has, when the Maras have eaten Diomedes himself, and they're asleep in the process of digestion, or bogged down in the process of digestion, he dares to harness them, and as they come back to life again, he races the ship back, going all the way around, and he beats the ship back to Greece, and then the horses are given to Eurystheus, who dedicates them to Hera, and they are then left loose on the mountain. This brings out another side of it, because the taming of a horse by the hero in the initiate always has to do with the taming of the astral vehicle, which is both etheric and desire body, and it has to deal with, we know that horses in the astrological sense are associated with Sagittarius and long trips, and that the taming of the horse has to do with the labor of learning how to take soul flights, because, you know, one thought and you're off and away, you know, and that's one of the great problems because it's so easy to get spaced out in your thought when you're not anchored by your physical body, and wherever your thought goes is where your soul body goes when you're having your astral flights. And the taming of the horse has to do with getting control of your body when it's most likely to be rebellious and to point it where you want it to go. Again, that's it. Next time we'll try to talk about the last four labors, and I want to bring out, it'll be something like tonight, but I want to bring out a few different things, and I want to talk about sequence again, but I want to talk about sequence not in a vehicular sense, but in the sense of logic, why this follows this, follows this, follows this. And sort of a initiologic or a cosmologic, as it's found in the process of initiation. I'm sorry it took so long. I wanted to be done in an hour, but